compatibility is not a reason for divorce, it's a reason for marriage.
God calls us to wholeheartedly live for Him, to love people in the way that is truly centered on others. As we read 1 Corinthians 13, it's a love that bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Ladies, today on Gateway to Joy, Elizabeth Elliott shares another lesson in following the Master. Here's Elizabeth Elliott.
When the disciples heard the call of Jesus, "Come and follow me," we read that Matthew immediately left his tax collector's booth, and several of the other disciples left their nets. The sons of Zebedee left Zebedee. They left their boats and their nets. We don't read a word about how bad they felt about it. They just leaped up and followed him and left everything behind, little imagining the cost of what that following was going to mean. When Jesus comes to you and me and says, "Do you want to be my disciple?" He never gives us a blueprint of what's going to be involved. He does not outline the whole will of God for our lives and say, "Do you like this? Will you take it?" He simply says, "Do you love me? Will you trust me? Well then, be my disciple." And that means giving up your right to yourself and taking up your cross and follow me. The glory of sacrifice at the beginning looks great. And I talk to many starry-eyed young people who would love to be missionaries. They'd love to work overseas. They'd love to do something really tough for God. And I certainly was one of those myself. I think back to all the missionary heroes that I had and the missionary books that I read. And one of the poems that I memorized somewhere or other along the way came to me when finally I really believed that God had called me to be a foreign missionary. And it expressed exactly the way I felt. I heard him call, "Come follow." That was all. My gold grew dim. My soul went after him. Who would not follow if they heard him call? You don't know what the cost is going to be. And nobody could possibly be ready to accept previews of all the coming attractions involved in discipleship. Jesus said to his disciples, "I have many things to tell you, but you can't bear them now." A bridegroom might say that to a bride too, mightn't he? "I have many things to reveal to you about who I am that in all these weeks or months or maybe years of acquaintance, you don't have a clue about." But of course, the bridegroom has very little clue about them himself, because marriage is a revelation as well as a revolution. We don't really know ourselves until we are in an intimate relationship with another fallible human being. One of the things that I reminded my daughter of in this little book that I mentioned, Let Me Be a Woman, was that she was going to be marrying a sinner. There isn't anything else to marry. And don't you forget that your husband or your wife is also married to a sinner. And we do not know what is going to be in that prize package. This same lady that told me how much she loved dogs and said, "The measure of your love is the measure in which you're willing to be inconvenienced," she said to me one day, she said, "You know, Betty dear, we're none of us prize packages. Just look for the essentials and skip the rest." And I thought, well, that's very good advice, very wise advice, especially after you get married. Because this prize package that you certainly thought you were getting, or you would never have married him or her, turns out to be a surprise package, doesn't it? There are all kinds of things in there that you were not expecting. Whenever you hear anybody explain why they got a divorce, it seems as though in every case they'll say, "Well, we've grown apart. She's not the woman I married. I'm not the woman who married him. He's not the man I married. We've changed so much. Well, I want to say, so what else is new? What did you think you were getting? If you're marrying a real live human being, there are going to be many changes. And there are going to be many revelations. And there are going to be many revolutions in your life if you're going to make it work out. We can't know the cost in advance. And we are all, let's face it, incompatible. I remember, I think it was here in Wisconsin, I heard Jill Briscoe talk many years ago to a large audience, and she said, "I'm going to let you in on a secret. Did you know that Stuart and I are incompatible?" And she said, "We live with an incompatible," I've forgotten how many children she has, "an incompatible son, an incompatible daughter, and an incompatible dog and an incompatible cat. And it takes a whole lot of the grace of God for us to get along for even one day at a time." And she said, "Sometimes when Stuart is away, she'll get a phone call, and the lady says she wants to talk to the pastor, and Jill says, 'Well, I'm sorry, he's out of town. Could I help you?' And the lady's in tears, and she says, 'No, I need to talk to the pastor. It's a very personal matter.' And Jill has on a few occasions had the temerity to say, 'Well, I bet I know what your problem is. Incompatibility.' And the lady gasps and says, 'Yeah, well, how did you know?' And she says, 'Well, I just had a sneaking suspicion that that might be it, because every now and then I hear people talk about incompatibility. But you know, incompatibility is not a reason for divorce. It's a reason for marriage. We're all incompatible.'" And I think that's absolutely true. I have had three husbands. I still have number three. He's still sitting out there. He's still feeling okay, as far as I know. And we're both hoping that there is no number four waiting in the wings. But all of them are very different. And I know that each of them had some of the same kinds of difficulties with me, but I had different kinds of difficulties with each of them. And there was a sense in which I was incompatible with each of them. Now, don't go out of here and say that I've had very bad marriages. They were wonderful marriages, both of the first two and the present one. But I know myself to be a sinner. And so where is this glory of sacrifice that we look at? We can't know the cost in advance. We don't see what the sacrifices are going to be. And it turns out that we are incompatible. And yet, we are building a home in love. We are building a new entity, a place, an arena where the mystery of Christ in the church is to be enacted. I like to think of the Christian home as a theater in which this tremendous spiritual drama is enacted of Christ and the church. And the husband is enacting the part of Christ, and the wife is enacting the part of the church. And we play out this drama as we live together as human beings, down to earth, fallible sinners. If we're going to live together 365 days a year, it's going to take a whole lot of grace of God and a whole lot of saying, "I'm sorry, please forgive me," and a whole lot of rolling with the punches, isn't it? Now, the third thing that I wanted to say is that every sacrifice, according to Mark 9, is to be salted with fire. Now, I don't really know what that verse means, and I have never found anybody that has been able to expound it very clearly to me. But there is something that my imagination gets a hold of here. In the Old Testament, salt was used in some of the sacrifices. But salted with fire, that's not a phrase that occurs in the Old Testament. And in that passage, Mark 9, verses 43 to 50, let me read that from the New English Translation. "If your hand is your undoing, cut it off. It is better for you to enter into life maimed than to keep both hands and go to hell, and the unquenchable fire. And if your foot is your undoing, cut it off. It's better to enter into life a cripple than to keep both your feet and be thrown into hell. And if it is your eye, tear it out. It is better to enter into the kingdom of God with one eye than to keep both eyes and be thrown into hell, where the devouring worm never dies and the fire is not quenched. For everyone will be salted with fire. Now, Jesus is making some outrageous statements here. He's describing the price of discipleship. And he's startling these multitudes. Mind you, Jesus is not just talking to the disciples here, this intimate small group. He's talking to the multitudes. Do you think he's going to sell these concepts? Is he going to win a popularity contest with this kind of talk? But he says, you're going to have to lose some perfectly legitimate things. You know, people sometimes wonder, now why would God take away this great gift that he had given me? What would be wrong with that? What was wrong with this or that that I lost? If your house burns down, for example, or if you lose something valuable, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's something wrong with it. It means that God has a lesson here to teach you. And there's certainly nothing wrong with your hand and your foot. Those are parts of the body that God has created. And the eye, we would consider one of the most essential parts of the body, but Jesus said it's better to enter into the kingdom of God with one eye than to keep both eyes and be thrown into hell, where the devouring worm never dies and the fire is not quenched. For everyone will be salted with fire. Salt is a good thing, but if the salt loses its saltness, what will you season it with? And I take that to mean that the sacrifice is going to be costly. It's a glorious thing because it means love and creating an entity in which love is ruling. But it is also going to be costly.
You've been listening to Gateway to Joy with Elizabeth Elliott, author of over 20 books, including Shadow of the Almighty, The Life and Testament of Jim Elliott. Join us next time for more encouragement and challenge from Elizabeth Elliott. This has been a production of the Bible Broadcasting Network.